The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Welcome to the DeSilver Studio. Listening to the community profiles on the Flypod.com New Media Network. I'm your host, Stephen J. Lowenstein, and I'm here today with Susan Cranley. Among other distinctions, she is the mother of Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley. Susan, welcome to our studio. Well, we just listened to your son talk to a group of people. What was going through your mind as you were listening to him talk?
Listening to John talk is always informative, and I say informative because I think most people think, oh, when we're together, all you do is talk politics, what's going on in the city, what's next, what's happening, but that's not the case. We have a family history that in John's case goes back 40 years, so that when we're together, memory is as much as part of what we're doing as anything. Plus, he offers us our grandchild, Joseph, who most people think they know where the sun rises and sets, but my husband and I now know for sure where it rises and sets, so that we're delighted when we have an opportunity to be together as a family. We also have another son who lives in Florida. So family time is truly that. It's time to hang out and be a family. Not that politics don't come up, but it is not the focus of when we're together as a family unit.
Did you know early on, or when did you know he was going to go into politics? Was it something that he displayed young as a child and an interest, or how did he get to wanting to be involved in local politics?
I think that the first thing that we discovered about John is that his belief that you leave your community better than you found it. We did that as a family principle, whether it was putting a neighbor who might be a little bit older, who it would be a delight to have their trash can put in for them or a newspaper put right on their front stoop. Those sorts of things where we encourage the boys to do from an early age. We lived in Price Hill. We chose to use the Catholic school system, which puts a emphasis on volunteer work as you go through. He then, from St. William, went to St. X High School, which had volunteering as a huge component of their program, and John took to it. It rose to the top, ran the, can't remember the exact name, but the service projects, working and mentoring on the weekends. He tutored. They were allowed to leave school to tutor a couple of times a week. He did all of that. Then he chose a Jesuit university, and at that university, he became very involved in the student politics. Up until college, it had been volunteer work in terms of the mentoring, the whatever. And then when he went to the university, he found the way to serve the greater university was through the student body and did a lot of work to get students engaged on the campus. And then from there went to law school. And in law school, you know, they grind you under, but became active enough that by the time he left Harvard, he gave the graduating speech. He was selected by his classmates to give the graduating speech.
You don't often see divinity students becoming involved in politics. They'll talk about it. They'll make recommendations, but actually, hands-on, get the hands dirty.
When John came to us and told us after his first year of law school that he was also going to pursue a degree from the divinity school, we were, what? Because we didn't understand where it was taking him and his path. And he said that as important to him as law school was and where it was leading him, he felt that he really needed to stay in touch with and further shape what I would term, I don't believe it was his term at the time, his core values. And they are served with a rich spiritual life. And by going to divinity school, he had a way to honor that as he pursued his law degree. It was already very clear that John was going into public service. It was so clear that when
did you know that?
During his junior year of college, He applied for what is known as a Truman Scholarship, mm-hmm. and that is awarded to no more than 65 students a year. I don't know if you can reapply, but you apply during your junior year. It is awarded after your junior year, and it is a goodly sum of money to help you with your senior year and to launch you into your postgraduate work in terms of what degree comes next for you. It could be law, it could be economic, it could be something. The thought is that you're using the money to better educate yourself so that you can be at the public service. It does not necessarily go to people who are going to elected office. You might be deciding to go into government in some role in policy or whatever, but those are the Truman Scholars that you will end up in the public sector.
Okay.
And John won that award.
So I have seen other people with multiple degrees in a variety of fields. And oftentimes it's a dissatisfaction they become. I have one friend who went to veterinarian school, didn't like that, went to medical school, didn't like that, went to law, and was brilliant in all of them. All of the things that John has done, though, are aimed toward public service and his going to law school, going to divinity school. It was always public service in the background. What effect did your public service as a member of the school board have?
My public service when John was growing up, which obviously would be far more formative than my school board, which I'll give you as an aside in a minute, we were very local in how we behaved. You know, we had the global discussions, but as a family, it was think globally, act locally. I became very concerned about things at home. We are not necessarily an all-Democrat family. John is a Democrat. I'm a Democrat, but that does not necessarily hold true for his father,
yes.
who does vote for him and does believe in him thoroughly, but his dad is a Republican.
Registered Republican.
So the idea of discussing things at home, I gave back to the schools the boys went to. I also went back and got further education while the boys were in school. So, you know, it became balanced. But, you know, when you were the room mother or there was a field trip or any of those kinds of things, I felt my time and talent was best used by enriching the education of the children of our neighborhood as they were going through the school system, because all school systems are pinched. So you have to have other things available done by the parents that help. And then my public service became I went to work in education, which I believe is a form of public service. I know very few teachers who don't stay after school, who don't tutor children, not for money, but because if you come in early and they'll come in early, or if you'll stay late and work with them, that you can truly, it always sounds so corny, but you can truly touch the future. So I did through education. Actually, when I ran for school board, John was already elected to council and well-liked, so it certainly didn't hurt me that I shared his last name. I think he was more of a help to me than I was to him. Although as my husband, and I'll put it in a plug-in for this, as my husband likes to say, I got more votes than John did. Now, the school district is a little larger than the city.
Oh, is it?
When he ran for council and he and I ran, and I ran for school board, there are parts of other communities that are
outside
on the school
city
board.
Limits.
But when you go through, I did in some, even some precincts, get more votes than he did.
So when there's a difference in the family, how do you handle that? You got a Republican and two Democrats. And has it changed now that he's mayor?
It hasn't changed a lot. As a family that is divided in its politics in terms of how they're practiced by claiming a party, we look for the commonalities. We do believe that there is a greater good, and we do believe that we have to look for the greatest good for the greatest number. So although we still will disagree on how we achieve that, we are willing to accept that it must be achieved.
Okay.
So you give credit where credit's due.
So he discusses things with you now, even as mayor?
Yes. We talk about things, and he talks about them as much with his father as he does with me.
Okay.
There are times when we have it sort of as a informal chat with all of us present, and there are times that he'll call his dad and say, Dad, what do you think about this? Or he'll call me and, Mom, what do you think about that? Obviously, his schedule is such that there are not huge amounts of time that we spend together alone talking policy. we do try to get together for lunch once a month, where it's just the two of us.
Oh, that's good.
And spend an hour or so just chatting. But once again, he'll ask me what's going on. I'll ask him what's going on. So, of course, you touch into some of that professional life, because being mayor, even though you're elected, is your professional life. It is a profession at this point, if that's what you're doing. But we also talk about his son, our grandson, and his wife and what they're doing. And he talks about what my husband Jay and I are doing. So it's like two normal people. I think that people forget that mayors are just as normal as the rest of us. My father always used to say, everybody puts their pants on the same way, one leg at a time.
So did mine. So did mine. Mine said the same. He was a tailor. So, you know.
But that's true. And I think most of us in our lifetime don't know politicians, so that there's a tendency to hold them to be a little bit different than other people. They just took a different life path. They're the same as the schoolmate that he was in high school. He somehow didn't change. He is who he was. This is the path he took. He has classmates that became doctors. He has a classmate who chose to learn a skill and become a master plumber. He has a classmate. They have lots of different paths they took, but they're still ultimately who they are. And when you sit around and laugh, unfortunately, we were at a funeral last week, and I saw John and his classmates, whether they were at St. X or at Elder, which is classically a rivalry, but he had friends in both because most of our neighbor children chose to go to Elder. He chose to go to St. X. But they're deeply friends.
He chose to go to St. X.
Well, his father, who went to St. X, had something to say about it, too. But John wanted to go to St. X. When you had asked earlier, did I know this was all going to happen? No, I didn't know it was all going to happen. But whoever a person uniquely is starts early on. When John was in the eighth grade, they gave an award at the school called the John McCoy Scholarship, which, being a Catholic school, showed that you lived a deeply Christian life, you were a good example, you took a part, you volunteered, you helped others, sort of that Christian ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And he won that award. He also won, and I will go on record, I went on record that night, I was, and I still am, perturbed when I think back over it. They also gave him, when they acknowledged it, he already had the award that for the whole year. It was his tuition was paid for that eighth grade year by the school system in the church. They gave him the religion reward, and for the first time ever, they had him read a paper because it had won a state award. And so they had him read it at graduation, and he got some other award. And the principal said to me as we left, we really should have called this John Cranley night, and I still am furious. And I said, yes, and isn't that a shame? There were 78 other kids in this class. If you give someone the top award, I could see perhaps giving him the religion reward too, because his faith was important to him already.
Was it?
Yes, very. It is.
He was how old at this time?
In the eighth grade.
Eighth grade.
But you have 77 other kids. You could have given awards to other kids. Just because the teachers, whatever John award, once you give someone the top award, and perhaps religion, because it's a religious-based school, after that, you give the awards to other people. You already said to him, you're our ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I find that to be, and I still, that to me is a social justice issue. And social justice issues just fire me up, whether it's a little one or a big one, I get fired up. He went on to high school at St. X, won the St. Ignatius Loyola Award, which would be the same as the John McCoy Scholarship. So he repeated that award at St. X and got the religion award there. Then went on to John Carroll, which is a Jesuit university.
Right.
Those Jesuits get a hold of you. You got to stay with
getting
them.
Getting the feeling he likes Jesuits.
Yeah. And he got into the politics there and was student of the year. I'm not sure whether it was twice or once, but I know he was student body president, which is very unusual, as a junior and reelected as a senior. So he became immersed in the politics. It's there and did very well. And as I mentioned earlier, then he went to Harvard, and your classmates at Harvard determine who gives the graduating speech, and it was determined that it was him.
Let's go and talk. Now, we've talked about your influence and your husband's, his father's. What about his wife? And I'd like you to talk, too, a little bit about what she's trying to do in the city also.
Dina is truly a gift to our family. She brings savvy, poise, sophistication, a very involved mother who is blessing us with a wonderful grandson. She has worked a great deal herself, has had much professional reward and accomplishment. And when John was elected mayor, she was making some phone calls at John's behest. And the story, as it's been reported, is very true. She reached out to some of the African-American ministers in the city to make sure that they felt included in the mayor's celebration and the swearing in. And as she did that, one of the ministers said, you know, you really need to talk to my wife. And she hooked up with Barbara Lynch, who is Damon Lynch's wife. Through their discussions, now there is really, really a first, it's called the First Ladies, and it organically grew here. As it turns out, it is being done other places. This isn't an exact replication because you're not ever doing things exactly the same because all cities are different. But basically, it is the First Ladies of the African American churches coming together to tackle health problems. As we know, people that are economically challenged have real health concerns that need to be addressed. And to address them means a huge fundamental change in diet and exercise, and diet often includes exercise, but both of those things. And it means cultural changes. Food that is traditionally, think of the recipes in your family that have been passed down for generations. They tend to be the ones that should only be an occasional treat. It shouldn't be a day-to-day, this is what I'm going to eat. But those kinds of changes, when those are treasured recipes and a family history, it's going to take a lot to change that. And you have to do that by meeting people where they are, helping them to understand that perhaps this should be an occasional thing and I've got to substitute this for that the rest of the time. So that she will be working with the First Ladies of the churches to do health screenings, work on exercise program, community walks, whatever it takes to change the health outcomes for many areas that the churches serve. And it just grew out of one phone call. She took it and ran away with it. And it's been phenomenal. And it, I think it's great because Dina doesn't need to be in John's shadow. She is as remarkable as he is. So she is giving back to the community in a really important way.
Didn't part of this initiative to involve, correct me if I'm wrong, doing something about the infant mortality?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Infant mortality is, it's shameful that in Cincinnati our infant mortality rate is one of the highest there is. I think that also has to do with the fact that we admit that we have more people living below the poverty line per capita in a city our size than most any other city in the nation, and that means crowded conditions. Babies not sleeping in cribs.
I think our infant mortality rate is double the national average, if my memory's right.
It's close to that, yes. And so you need to educate young mothers, all mothers, on how to keep their children safe, particularly when they're sleeping, about what to do when they're crying, you know, what's the indication that you need to go to the doctor. When you have a population that not only has challenges around economics and transportation and all those things that come with being economically challenged, access to health care is an issue. So something chronic with a child might not be caught until it's an emergency room visit, mm-hmm. and an emergency room visit can be too late. Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that they talk about constantly about educating them, and I know that as a high school educator for years, when we would have a child and a teenager, they don't like to be called children, but a child in high school, have a baby, to talk to them about, do not sleep in bed with that baby. No matter how tired you are, don't take that baby to bed with you because they're tired, they're trying to go to school during the day. And this is just an example. It happens for any number of reasons. Babies don't belong in beds with adults that are sleeping because that's one of the things that really drives our infant mortality rate up, along with the lack of good transportation to get to the doctor's appointments, the food deserts that we have in the city, so that you really aren't getting the kinds of foods that are the healthiest for your child as they move on from infancy to toddler and you introduce foods. You go right from the breastfeeding or bottle feeding to such highly processed food because that's what you can get.
It's cheap, easy, and convenient.
Right.
That's the problem.
Yes.
I remember watching you the night your son got elected mayor. I can't put into words, but I'm going to ask you, can you describe what was going through your mind at that time?
That was a moment of unadulterated joy.
Absolutely. Okay.
Just unadulterated joy.
You could feel it coming through the camera.
Oh, it was. It's a tough race. All races are. And because Cincinnati's open field in a city that we already know is a Democratic city, to have two Democrats that have been popular. And
I think they got along rather well for a long time.
They did. And to have them pitted against each other, even though we had every, and I say we because obviously I volunteered on the campaign. But negatives have a way of sticking. So you get nervous. And John's run for offices before that he hasn't won. So this was the biggest one. Not that city council races weren't big races, but when you have to only finish in the top nine to be on council, you've got more wiggle room.
Mm-hmm.
When it's a winner-take-all race, there's that. And you hear negative things, and people are actually, I felt people were very kind in terms of listening and being open. But there's always somebody who has to tell you about their axe to grind. Like they tell you with a habit or anything, it
takes
7 days.
Like going to a confessional.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where the divinity training comes in handy.
Yeah. Or the idea that, you know, you have to do something 7 times before it becomes a habit, or it takes 7 positives to overcome a negative. I think all those things worked onto it. But it was unadulterated joy that night.
Oh.
He'd worked hard. I felt it was the right time and the right place for him to be, and that he got to be there. It was pretty exciting.
What's the most difficult obstacle you think he's had to overcome?
I think John's life has been fairly blessed. He has tended to be in the right place at the right time. And we've always said that success is when hard work meets opportunity. John's a hard worker. He has a work ethic that I can't take responsibility for. We certainly modeled it. He's a people pleaser. That's a personality type. He cares deeply about other people. I think that when you talk about opportunity, I think that he's taken challenges. He was on council when we had, don't call them riots, we call them the civil disturbances. But right after that, it was, how are we going to change things? And he saw that he had, wasn't necessarily the path you would have thought it would have turned in for him, but he went to the UC Law School, worked with them, and was co-founder of the Innocence Project,
right,
which as of yesterday got out yet another person.
Another? 20 then?
I don't know because the counts, whenever you read them, are somewhat different, but it is approaching 20. 20 people that were incarcerated for very long periods of time, many of them who did nothing else wrong. I think that we often comfort ourselves by thinking, gosh, oh, well, maybe they didn't do that, but they've done so many other things. This is sort of like when we see on the basketball court, that what we call that even up call. If you assume that, you're awfully wrong. Some of these people are incarcerated for life, usually with the testimony of someone who said, oh, he looked like. So then the theory gets it to that person who looked like. That look-like person becomes the person of interest. Then we collect evidence that proves that that's what happened. The question really was, what was his biggest challenge or the biggest thing to overcome? I think probably it is to be so committed. Because people who are serious and committed often then are so passionate that other people are like, oh, really? Can't we just watch the football game?
Well, politics is hard, regardless of what your political preferences are. To achieve something politically is very difficult to do if you have a sincere belief.
I don't think anyone who's ever worked with John, he understands that you have to compromise, that if you're a human being, and we preach this at home, there has to be compromise. No two people can have it their own way all the time. You're going to have to work with somebody else, and you're going to have to sometimes compromise. But you never have to work outside your core values. If it comes up against what you see as a core value, which is the dignity of all human beings.
So when people are critical of him, what angers you the most about what they're saying.
I have no problems with people disagreeing with John. Of course, in Cincinnati, the most thing that comes to mind the most often is the streetcar. I don't care if people are for the streetcar. It doesn't make any difference to me. But if your distaste for opposition to the streetcar leads you to personal attacks, that infuriates me. But once again, I believe that's a social justice issue. We disagree with people on issues. We don't attack them for who they are.
But that's the politics. It's got to be aggravating.
It's aggravating, but do you know how much if you just say, oh, it's a streetcar proponent, and you dismiss that, as long as vitriolic as they can be, if they stick to what they think the numbers are and what that, it doesn't bother me. But when they say, well, he's a, you know, this and he's a that, and they take to the personal attack, that bothers me a great deal, because I don't think we have the right to attack each other as human beings. As human beings, we owe it to each other to respect people. Our respect can take different roles. I can respect you, but think, gosh, I wish you could change this behavior, you know, but I have to meet you where you are. But personal attacks are, I don't understand the need to attack anyone personally ever. I can attack you for your ideas. I can try to change your mind, but I don't have the right to go after your mental capabilities, your physical things. I don't have the right to call you names. Those are despicable traits. So,
what would you like to see him do next after his time's up for being mayor?
That's a question that I've been asked frequently. I want, for both my children and obviously my grandchild and the people in my life, I want them to pursue something that also gives them a measure of happiness. Sometimes what you need to do, as we define happiness and joy, isn't that ebullient, you know, whatever. What it is a fact that you find an inner peace. So I want for him what keeps allowing him to find peace in what he does. I believe that he totally believes that he will be mayor for 8 years. I think it's important to have that 8-year term, because then the continuity and be able to get some things started and at least building the capacity to let them go on so that it becomes a true change. I do know, and I do not know the name of the organization, but there is someone who has died and left a great deal of money with the hopes that the money they left could help us change in the way we relate to each other, particularly in the role of politics. And politics being more than the elected official, politics and politicians also being the policymakers and the people who are appointed to do different things within the public sector. And this organization, it was founded as a foundation by this gentleman, identifies 15 Democrats and 15 Republicans and brings them together. They're called Rising Stars. They tend to be younger. And as Rising Stars, they go and work together on issues 3 weekends a year. And the expenses for that are paid for by the foundations, like a retreat, but to work with equal numbers on both sides to talk about where do we beginning. I think that the parallel I'll make happens to be a religious one. We look at all the time at the differences between Islam and Christianity and Judaism, forgetting that they're all Abrahamic religions. So why aren't we looking at the commonalities? Mm-hmm. And working from there rather than doing a complete Venn diagram and then making sure that we're on farthest outreach. As we talk to each other.
I've never understood about humans in general. We tend to emphasize the negative more so than we do the positive. Why? It seems like it's human nature, and I'm going, why is that human nature?
I don't understand it. I agree with you totally. So this group of 30 people are going to meet 3 times, and John was selected. You cannot apply for it. They identify you. So when you ask what's next, I think it may be an outgrowth, because this goes on. It's not a 3-time and done. They're doing some kind of connecting thing. So I think that there are people who have identified him as someone who will continue to play a role in the public sector.
This is not Leadership Cincinnati.
We're talking. This is all over the country.
It's
30 people all over the country. It's 15 Republicans and 15 Democrats, all of
no
whom
independence?
Have been.
No independence? No.
I don't believe so. I think it's by the party. I know. But it's they're identified with either the parties, and they're identified as rising stars. So he will be participating in that, and I'm certainly sure that that in some way will help him with his next steps.
Lastly, what's your favorite book or poem?
It's strange you would ask that. My favorite book changes up often. Currently on the must-read list is probably Mary Daria Russell's The Sparrow, only because it talks about how life is more of a process and that what we take too often, we say the goal is this, but actually the goal can never be met because it's only as good as the day that you're doing it. So that you have to look at the process as opposed to the goal. And the definitions can vary widely. My definition of beauty may not be yours, but we both operate as if we shared the same definition. Right now, I'm in my late 60s, and actuaries will tell you if you can make it through your 60s, you'll probably make it to your 80s. So I've been burying far too many friends lately. And Emily Dickinson has a beautiful poem. I'm not a quoter. I should have memorized it if I'd known there was going to be a pop quiz today. Basically, it just said, but I know there is a heaven as if the checks were given. You know, that if you don't know all of these, it doesn't mean that you've never walked on a moor, that there's no moor, and you've never done these things. You still know what you know that they be, and she's assured that there's a heaven as if the checks were given. And I find comfort in that for people who struggle. I mean, it's interesting, towards the end of life, if you happen to be talking to friends that toward their end of life, the things that they worry about, you know, which makes them uncertain about the next step.
And such as?
A friend just lost, in her case, it was a mother-in-law, but the mother-in-law had a child who had a real physical challenge, and this was over 50 years ago, and medical science didn't really know what they know now. And when her grandchildren had that, it was treated. But she thought, oh, I could have been a better mother because my child died, but my grandchildren didn't. She couldn't understand. I have a dear, close friend my own age who just died. She was worried because she was just too tired to keep on. And so hospice had helped her and the family and all of us, actually. But, you know, is it all right to give up? She didn't give up. She just wouldn't do anything extraordinary anymore. You know, and then worried about what does this mean as a believer in both of these cases that I'm speaking about, there's a belief in the afterlife. What is this going to mean in terms of my afterlife, that I didn't fight any harder or I didn't help my child more? And the God I believe in doesn't care. You know, he isn't going to say, oh, you weren't a good mother. He isn't going to say, oh, you quit fighting. He's going to say, welcome.
Susan, I want to thank you for joining me here today on Community Profiles. Listeners, that's my show for today. I've been your host, Stephen J. Lowenstein, and my guest today has been Susan Cranley. Thanks for joining us here on the Community Profiles. If you have any comments about today's program, we want to hear from you. Just leave your public comments directly on the player page displayed in front of you at this very moment. Our programs come to you free and clear on the portable media device or computer through our media network, theflypod.com. When it comes to the media, we are what's next. Until next time, thank you for joining us here on Community Profiles.